I just spent the morning at a three-day conference. I say that because somehow they managed to compress 3 days of chat into 3 hours. It was organised by the Centre for Science Communication at the UTS in collaboration with CSIRO and had a number of Australia's top scientists debating the pros and cons of genetically modified food and cloning and human transgenics with a bunch of somewhat puzzled journalists. And, well, there's a lot of ground to cover, so there wasn't a lot of time to discuss the ethical and social aspects of GM food. Which brings me to this discussion. The focus here is to push for is to see where the push for genetically modified food is coming from, who's going to benefit, and is it safe? We have Dr. Gail Jennings, a science journalist and broadcaster. You'll remember Gail from the 7:30 report and from Quantum, as well as quite a lot of time with her own show on ABC Radio. Sitting opposite me, Professor Snow Barlow from the University of Melbourne, where he's the Grand Fromage in the Department of Resource Management and Horticulture. And we hope we'll have, because he's rushing from the airport, I think, a bloke called Dr. Jonathan Banks. He's a sort of a class traitor, I think you could describe him as, because he's been a scientist with CSIRO, and he's now growing organic apples. No chemicals, and lots and lots of varieties. One of them, in fact, is the very apple, well, the same species, that inspired Newton to pronounce his laws of gravity. He explained to us that it's a very heavy apple and it always falls off the tree. So if Newton had been sitting under a different sort of apple tree, there'd be no gravity and we'd all have drifted off into space. But we're not sure whether he's going to front, because we've lost him. Gail, give us a bit of a thumbnail here. We've only got a couple of genetically modified crops in Australia.
Yes, but we do have a large number of ingredients in our food. We have at least 500 different types of genetically engineered ingredients, if you like, that are in various numbers of our food, and we're not actually able to identify them all because we haven't
had to identify them. That's another issue, but on the ground we've got what, cotton? And blue carnations. And
yes, in terms of products, we've got two different kinds of flowers. We've got cotton and we've got crown, something that's against its vines, isn't it, Snow?
Vines and horticultural crops, you know, apples.
Horticultural crops is the other one we're actually growing here. Of course, the flowers aren't food, and there's cottonseed oil from the cotton, and there is we are getting some of the viticulture.
So, Snow, we actually eat some cotton, do we, in effect?
Well, I think some of the cottonseed oil will find its way into the food chain.
Well, okay. Now, Gail, are we also testing genetically modified crops on the hush-hush a bit?
Well, there's been reports that we are. We have certainly been for a very long time testing genetically modified crops in field in laboratories, in glasshouses, and then in field trials, which is small areas that are roped off. And there have been reports in the paper that I haven't cross-checked that there are private secret crops being grown, genetically modified crops being grown on public land, and a lot of farmers, I believe, are very concerned about this because if they have land that's adjacent to these genetically modified crops, they don't have any guarantees. They feel that those genetically modified genes won't drift into their crops.
But we don't have to worry, do we, Snow, because of the Office of the Gene Technology Regulator?
Well, those crops at present are actually under if they're legal, they're under the auspices of the GMAC, the Gene Manipulation Advisory Committee, because they're experimental. Because we really
now, are you on that?
No.
No. No, right. I thought you were on everything, so.
No, don't have time to be on that. But it's got some very eminent scientists on it, but also across a much broader group of ethicists and economists as well.
Well, how do you get approval to be tested even? How do you get to that stage?
Well, you go to GMAC. GMAC has a procedure that says that there are different levels, and some levels get approved within institutions. In other words, they do things within labs of a certain security. But then if you want to go to field releases, you have to go to the GMAC committee. And GMAC then deliberates whether this is too dangerous to do under the current rules, or whether you should do it in a glasshouse, or whether it's fine to put it out in the field at this point as an experimental, but not to commercialise it. The Office of the Gene Regulator is being brought in for commercial applications of gene technology.
Can you stop thumping the desk for emphasis? Because what it does is the whole building reverberates and people all over Australia fall out of bed. Apart from that, it's going well. Now,
a bit of bondage at this point.
Now, if Jonathan Banks was here, he'd be complaining bitterly that it's not safe to test and how can you test and there's no control group for the population. What about this argument that it's, in fact, terribly hard to test for safety?
Of course it is. It's hard to test for long-term safety on technologies that we're only just introducing. You know, how do you do a longitudinal study for 25 years on GM foods if you don't introduce some into the population who would do that study? But, you know, really we are doing that with a number of technologies. We didn't do that with the motor car. We didn't do that with the printing press either, for that matter.
Yeah, well, that was a serious mistake, wasn't
yes, that's
it? Letting that bust.
And then to leave the radio mics open. Yeah. Big mistake. Yeah, but we do it with pharmaceuticals and we do it with all other forms of human experimentation. And it's clear from consumer backlash against genetically modified foods, which in fact is quite great around the world for all the promise that it has held and probably still does hold, that people do want to know exactly what's going into their mouths and that they're not happy with the fact that there haven't been long-term studies on the impact it will have on their health, or on the health, I should say, of the environment. And if I could just go back a step from that again, you talk about GMAC, the Genetic Manipulation Advisory Committee, and the Biosafety Ethics Committees and all the other kinds of ethics committees within institutes, but there have been big questions over those too over the years, because they are staffed largely by interested parties. Even if they are very eminent people, they're still coming from a particular way of thinking that might not be as broad as the society at large. And it's a bit really like being slapped over the wrist with, you know, a wet cornflake. I mean,
now,
nothing
much
happens
just,
to you.
Would you just quietly munch on this blue carnation for a minute? Now, Snow, you were quite persuasive today about saying, look, you've got to have the genetically modified foods because how else are we going to feed the teeming billions? Mm. And you insist that this is the big argument for it, that we need to find a lot more nosh as our population continues to gallop.
Yeah, ultimately we do. I'm not in favour of a untested application of this new technology. I think we do need to proceed carefully. But we do have this this problem in front of us, that we have a population that increases by about 100 million a year.
Tie his hands back when you go.
I'll put them in my mouth till I really shut me up.
And we're not really finding any new croplands. So, you know, agricultural scientists know that they need to increase productivity by probably 2-3% a year in the foreseeable future to 2050, say, to stay with the population. So, you know, this technology provides the traditional plant breeders with another tool, which in my field will be very helpful in a number
of different
ways.
We happen to have found a traditional plant breeder. We found the apple man. Jonathan Banks is now with us. Jonathan, you've heard Snow's point that we need genetically modified foods to feed the planet. You dispute this.
Yes, Philip. I do. I think that there are lots of different ways to go, but I don't think that we in Australia are really in the business of feeding the planet. We're in the business of making money from agriculture, and we may not need those genetically modified organisms at all.
The distinction may be lost on the listener. You were making the point that we're boutique producers to the affluent.
Well, not really boutique, because we are major exporters, but we're nothing like the principal exporter of, say, wheat, and what we tend to do is to produce a quality product if we can and sell it to very advanced markets. And many of those advanced markets won't take genetically modified organisms.
We'll become a very large boutique producer.
Well, that's very nice then, yes.
Mm. What about the Office of Gene Technology Regulation? Were they going to protect us from TRIFIDs?
We are yet to see this, aren't we? I mean, the jury is very much still out on that. But certainly the progress to date has been that a number of GMOs have come in when the public really don't know about it. And they've come in, in my opinion, more or less on the nod rather than with separate testing in Australia or anything like that.
Now, back to snow. You're much more sanguine, aren't you, than Jonathan? Do you think that there's he exaggerates the dangers?
I wouldn't say he exaggerates. It's another view. I think that we need to really get behind the Office of Gene Regulation and give them the chance to prove to the public that they can have confidence in this regulatory system, because that's where the public are at present. The public are worried about consuming a new product which they haven't seen the safety data on, if you wish, and they haven't seen the advantages of eating.
As I think, as Gar was suggesting, though, many regulatory bodies become captives of the industry or the area that they that they're meant to regulate. This is not a danger with ours?
It's always a danger, but you know, that's the role of government, surely, in setting up these things, to set them up in a framework that doesn't let them be captured by one part of society. That's, you know, that's the role of government to do that. And the way this has been set up, I don't think it has been. It might be, as Gail says, when you get down into institutions, it's largely the research community dealing with those biosafety committees. But when you move up to a national scale, I think there are checks and balances there.
Gail, you were the one journalist who raised the point about the beneficiaries of the GM revolution. You asked who it was for. Who is it for?
I think that is obviously the $60 billion question, in fact probably larger than that. Clearly it will be when it's related to diagnostic medicine and to drugs and to even gene therapy for some deadly inherited diseases. It will be of some benefit to some human beings. But I think that it's likely to be of greatest benefit to the venture capitalists and the multinational corporations who are funding and driving and producing and marketing these new technologies. And I think that that raises the point, exactly as Snow was just saying, that if it's ultimately the role of our elected representatives to make decisions about how we regulate and how safe we make these new products, we then have to look at the strength and power of our governments when it comes to transnational corporations. And it would appear, and we in fact had this chat briefly today, that the nation state is almost no longer, and this has been obviously written about, talked about ad nauseum for quite some time, and that in fact transnational corporations have a vast amount of power in making and breaking economies, nations, genders, classes and so on. And it doesn't really matter what political leanings you have, the fact of the matter is that's what's happening with this technology and will happen with this technology. They are making products which they hope to find a market for. They'll push those products to make that market because they're in the business of making profits, and so it will be a difficult negotiation, I think, for governments to resist what transnational corporations do. I think that's the big challenge.
Well, quite a few times today, Jonathan talked about the helicopter. Let's lift the helicopter. I want to take it down to the ground and back to you, Jonathan, back to Pielago apples. Pielago means, dear listener, cleavage or a valley between two breast-like hills. I remembered that. Now, I'm looking at your card, which I kept, and you've got all these apple varieties, and when they come on stream, dozens and dozens and dozens, Lady Williams, Lord Lambourne, and all the rest. Now, as someone who's producing them organically, you must have an awful lot of problems with insects and stuff. Wouldn't you love... Snow Barlow to ring up and say, I have now got a slightly modified Red Delicious, which will never need water, which will ripen, you know, beautifully and stay ripe for at least 3 years, and which will shrug off insects. Wouldn't you be tempted?
Well, he's certainly a miracle worker, but I think I probably wouldn't be tempted, Philip, because a lot of people have a lot of different ideas of what an apple should be, and that's just one of them. And one of the problems about a lot of these new varieties is they have all sorts of extra things built in, but the public actually likes the ones they're used to. And so they're not actually looking for a new variety.
That's a remarkably conservative argument.
Well, it's not. It's a marketing argument.
Yeah.
I mean, if it was possible to sell them, and it's the same with grains and a number of other things, if it was possible to sell them, I'd have less of a problem. But if instead of selling them, nobody will buy them because they are not what they had as children.
Okay, let me put it this way. Can you imagine a future where genetic modification is so triumphant that it leads to the slow disappearance or the increasingly rapid disappearance of lots and lots of varieties and various forms of food?
Very much so. And I don't think it's just genetic modification that's doing that. The progress has been exactly that, a lot of traditional varieties are disappearing because they're difficult to grow and all that kind of thing, or particularly because they're free to everybody. And so your new GMO apple that Snow will have provided, he'll also say, and you'll pay me a royalty on this.
Will he? Is that what you're going to do, Jonathan, when you've got your new apple?
Can I ask Snow, would he ask a royalty on this?
Absolutely, because quite apart from GMOs, we're already paying royalties. There is a thing called plant variety rights in Australia at present, but quite apart from any genetic, any gene technology, the new, say, Pink Ladies, which I would beg to differ, if you look at the market for Pink Ladies, you will see that I think the populace has moved quite considerably away from good old Grannies and Delicious into Pink Ladies, and that's a new apple, and that is indeed patented. Well, patented is a plant variety, right? And you do pay, it's an Australian apple.
Oh, I'm sorry, you have me on the hop here. We do actually grow Pink Ladies. Worse than that, I don't think I'd pay any variety rights.
But you didn't plant them, though.
No, I've grafted them.
This is like a hypothetical. It's very exciting.
They are an excellent apple.
Can I add, though, that it's interesting what's different about genetically modified apples is the whole context from which it's coming, and I think that's why people are suspicious. I don't think people are necessarily suspicious of new markets. We're sitting ducks for new markets. We love new markets. I think people have got something about the Frankenstein part of it. That's why it's there in the headlines, even though I think that's terrifically tabloid and quite tacky. They are actually concerned that it's related in their minds to the mad scientist in the laboratory and the nasty multinational that gave them Agent Orange, and I'm not saying any specific multinational, I'm saying as a metaphor in their mind. And I think that it's got bad press, it's got bad associations, and I think for some good reason. I think there is a downside to some science and there is a downside to some multinationals.
Well, Snow, clearly this has not been consumer-driven. This is technological determinism rather than the punters out there saying, hey, I want a genetically modified apple.
Oh, absolutely. It is. Was DDT consumer-driven? No, it wasn't. Was any of the chemicals that have been introduced were introduced by chemical companies who synthesised them?
Well, we only ate them indirectly.
They have become market-driven, haven't they? Because everybody keeps on looking for the new insecticide to deal with the last lot of resistance.
Yeah, we all get hooked
on it. So that's now market-driven.
No, we all get hooked on a particular technology, and perhaps the same will happen with GMOs. But I agree with Gail in some ways. The agricultural industry needs to really embrace what will be required to, I guess, allay these, I call their primal fears that people have. And there's something different about gene technology, which I think people inherently have some reservations
about.
Well,
you helped organise the Consensus Conference last year, Snow, which mainly focused on labelling, GM labelling. What position do you take on that yourself?
I thought that in terms of labelling, quite apart from the cost, which is still whirling around, I think that people need to get comfortable with the technology. And I've always thought that the technology should be transparent. And that leads you to labelling. If you say that, it leads you inevitably to labelling. And I thought initially in the first applications of this technology, people needed to know. They needed to have a choice. And that is where I think the major problem has been with consumers. They have felt that they didn't have a choice.
Why do corporations feel differently about that? Why don't they happily provide the consumers with this information?
You get into logistic problems very quickly in a sense of if you look at the grain industry, if Farmer A is growing gene technology crop, Farmer B is not. And you then have to, at the silo, segregate those two crops.
And someone in the truck.
And not only in the silo, you've got to produce boundaries such that the one crop doesn't contaminate the other.
Yes.
So quarantining
is impossible.
And then you're
in the business of selling whether you can sign something to say that this crop is GM-free. Hmm. And at this moment, we can say that. But very shortly, I think we might not be able to say that because we don't actually know where the GM crops are being grown at this stage. It's being kept secret.
Jonathan, you were telling me off you know, off mic, as it were, and if this embarrasses you, forgive me, that if CSIRO scientists were polled, in your view, a majority of them would share your concerns?
Well, I think I was saying that basically they're no different from the rest of the population, and the rest of the population, it seems, when they're polled, come up with some 60-odd percent being quite unhappy with the processes at the moment.
Snow, you were making a point which I thought was very interesting this morning. You said, look, genetic engineering isn't monolithic. There's all sorts of forms and things going on, lots and lots of sciences within that science. Is it possible that Jonathan and others are right, that some of those activities are inspiring, wholly legitimate, enthralling, but perhaps genetic work in food is less wise?
Well, I think there's two points there. There is genetic research into the ingredients that you're putting into food and whether we introduce it at the pace we introduce it. And then there is these other technologies which are, as I said, you know, basically you can get to know much more rapidly, much more about the organism that you're dealing with, how to manage it, how to detect viruses, and how to do a number of things that you could then move to, you know, conventional technologies with. So I think what I'm saying is that in this particular area of food, it's one where we're going to have to hasten slowly, both hasten slowly and move with to get confidence, one, from a consumer population, that on the safety matter. But then there's that large thing that Gail, that large really concern of that Gail has introduced in terms, and this is the concern of, it's bound up with the multinationals and globalisation, who owns it and how we can really apply it. That's the thing that I think will equally entertain people as well as the safety.
Gail, we were talking the other night to some characters who were hot to trot on what had happened at Davos and at Seattle, American activists, and they were making the point that gender politics is fading away. Racial politics are, oddly enough, fading away in the US, and there's an increasing focus on the young to attack the multinational corporation. This will be a big battlefield then, won't it, if that's what's going to happen?
I'm surprised to hear it. I haven't seen much evidence of it here in Australia. I think it's interesting, I guess, because if it's true that multinationals have taken over from the nation state, then a lot of people have lost their voice and they're not prepared to anymore. And maybe there's been a cycle through the me generation back to people looking a bit further than that. Or maybe it's because of issues like this where people feel that they don't have control.
Well, look, I thank you for your help. It's been an interesting day, and obviously the debate is really just beginning. It's only just getting on the general public's radar screen, and it won't go away. Gail Jennings, Dr. Gail Jennings, science broadcaster, journalist, author, book coming out soon. I'll talk to you then again, Gail. Professor Snow Barlow, who's the head of the Department of Resource Management and Horticulture at the University of Melbourne, and the great-great-grandson of Joseph Banks, Dr. Jonathan Banks, formerly with CSIRO, and currently producing certified organic apples with remarkable names and variety. This is LNL on Radio National, Radio Australia, and the World Wide Web.